views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Burst.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Or if you care to, you can send us actual letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. The Final Straw is still soliciting artwork to put onto t-shirts, stickers, and more things. If you have an idea or an image, send us a link to The Final Straw Radio at riseup.net. Also, our show is free to stream and download. If there's a pirate broadcast or community radio station in your area that you'd like to hear us playing on, shoot us an email at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net, and we can look into helping to get us on your local airwaves. This week, we spoke with Amanda and Justin, who are members of the No New Animal Lab campaign based in Washington State. The campaign, which just finished a months-long national tour, aims to protest the building of a massive animal testing facility on the University of Washington campus in Seattle. In this interview, we will talk about the tour and how it went, as well as the state of the animal rights movement in the U.S. and topics such as solidarity. To learn more about them, you can visit nonewanimallab.com. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
There's a trend that's been happening for a long, long time where comparably wealthy people chase around poor people and kick them out of their living spaces. We now use the term gentrification to describe this social and economic phenomenon. Back in the old days, before FDR had the sprawling U.S. highway system built on the cheap by desperate folks who lost their jobs in the Great Depression, people wanted to live close to their work. And since factories were built largely in major cities, or else major cities popped up around the factories, that's where the workers lived. People with money were drawn to the city centers, and the poor were left in shantytowns and hovels on the fringes of the urban metropolises. Metropolises. Metropoles. Metropoli? I don't know. But anyway, it sucked to be in the burbs. As a consequence, the property values were really low. So when the highways magically appeared and everybody hopped into cars, the comparably wealthy folks said, "Hey, let's get away from the ugly city and buy up some of this cheap property away from the smog and exhaust." Since they had the means to commute to work, they thought it would be awesome to scarf up the living places of the desperately poor on the fringes. Developers come in, boom, the suburbs. Condominiums, strip malls, McDonald's, Starbucks. Life was grand for the comparably wealthy, but the desperate poor couldn't afford to rent that condo or to drink the latte whatever at Starbucks. So, being displaced, the poor migrated to the city spaces vacated by the upwardly and outwardly mobile. They took the hand-me-downs of the inner city. So what we essentially had was a city center that was a ghetto, plagued with poverty, unemployment, crime, drugs, and a variety of social ills, and the poor were essentially held there in a kind of prison formed by the ring of high property values that held them in. We fast forward to today, and we have the same processes at work, only in reverse. We're putting benevolent names on it, like urban renewal and reinvestment, but the process is still the same. The comparably wealthy see areas where property values are depressed, so they begin buying up, quote, islands, unquote, of renovation, islands that receive more protection by the police. These islands are off limits to the poor and largely black city populations, while attracting a migration of more wealthy whites. Again, just like previous historical instances of the poor being displaced, the influx of these suburbanites raises the property values and drives the poor from the area. Gentrification. So how do we effectively oppose it? My first reaction, in the simple answer, is that we have to refrain from participating in the gentrification process. But what does that mean? Does that mean we just don't move into the new area and pay higher rent that others cannot afford? That might be like a mandatory minimum requirement, I guess. But it seems to me that to effectively oppose gentrification, we have to identify all the profiteers who are gaining from gentrification, from the landlords to the corporate coffee shops. Once we identify them, we have to develop strategies for sabotaging their profits. That's what it boils down to, right? Because gentrification is driven by profit margin. So, in developing an anti-gentrification strategy, we have to develop an anti-profit strategy. We have to ask ourselves, if I were a slumlord or Starbucks or McDonald's, what would be the events that would drive me out of this neighborhood? What would force me to abandon the profit plans? And then do that. Some forms of resistance might be extreme single events that really rock the gentrifiers, while other forms of resistance are longer term, sustained actions. For stuff like that, you'd almost have to mobilize and inspire the local populace to take up the cause for themselves. You'd almost have to be able to articulate a vision of how folks getting gentrified could and should resist, connecting the dots between the profiteers and the rising rent prices that drive them into the new round of migration. Then, perhaps, those long-term sustained rebellions will occur seemingly on their own. One interesting idea would be to locate where the gentrifiers themselves live and follow them to their neighborhoods and impact the property values where they live. It's just an idea. As I'd like to point out quite frequently, gasoline is cheap and matches are free. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain being silenced by the prison official somewhere in the Ohio prison torture complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren, C.I., P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org. We're speaking with members of the No New Animal Lab campaign, which just completed a tour of the U.S. in order to raise awareness of their campaign. Thanks, y'all, for coming on. And do you care to introduce yourselves?
Sure.
I'm Amanda, and I'm one of the organizers of the campaign.
I'm Justin. I'm another organizer.
Cool. Will you tell us what is the No New Animal Lab campaign, and what were you hoping to get done with the tour?
So the No New Animal Lab campaign is a campaign that's actually turned into an international effort to stop the building of a new underground animal lab at the University of Washington on their Seattle campus. And we are focusing both on pressuring the University of Washington as the university that's planning to build the lab, as well as the construction company, which is Skanska. And they are contracted to be the general managers overseeing the construction of the lab, and they are a huge construction company, have offices throughout the world. They are based in Sweden and have offices also throughout the U.S. with their headquarters in New York. So this has given people throughout the U.S. a chance to get involved in the campaign, and that's the foundation that led to doing tour, because they have offices all over the country as well as executives' homes all over the country.
With tour, we had been doing a lot of groundwork in the Northwest. Amanda was living in Seattle. She lives in Portland now, which is where I've been living. And we built a really strong foundation here. A lot of action has happened here. Anything from office protests and disruptions to a lockdown at the site of the lab. And we've been doing a lot of pressure against Skanska executives regionally, but obviously they have executives all over the country. And so the tour was inspired by some of the stuff that Shaq used to do, which included tours of upper middle management and executives of companies that were investing in Huntington Life Sciences. And so we wanted to be able to take that model and basically take a protest tour around the country to pressure people that had a lot of influence within Skanska, within their company, people that were executives, senior vice presidents, executive vice presidents, chief operating officers, and even the CEO. And along the way, we also did a lot of networking with local communities that were involved in the campaign and were involved in other efforts and campaigns as well. So the tour was really a vehicle for building pressure against Skanska nationally while also helping rebuild the grassroots animal liberation movement, and meanwhile also doing some coalition building work along the way, stopping in Utah to meet with Utah tar sands folks. We went to Oak Flat in just outside of Phoenix, where Rio Tinto is trying to develop a copper mine on Apache territory. And we like to do those kinds of things when we're on the road, because we're also trying to build into the animal rights movement an ethic of coalition politics and solidarity with other communities and movements.
That's really, really rad. I didn't know that about the tour. I think it's super important for like anarchism to have solidarity with animal liberation and for like eco movements as well. So I think that's super cool. Just to clarify for listeners, the lab that was being protested in Seattle, was that a lab for animal testing, like vivisection and stuff like that?
Yeah, so their intent is for it to be two stories underground animal lab. They want to build it and then put grass back over the top so that people don't even know there are animals being tortured underground. And this would be for animals for invasive research. The University of Washington uses pretty much any kind of animal you could imagine in research, from primates to dogs to mice. They span pretty much all the animals. And they wanted to build this lab to be able to expand the number of animals that they have in research, especially to have more room to test on primates and other larger animals, including pigs and dogs. And they also want to have this lab to centralize research on campus so that they can get additional grant funding. They already get about $500 million a year just for animal research, and they want to be able to expand that. So as the university tries to present this public narrative of wanting to, you know, move away from using animals in research and invest in alternatives, meanwhile, we have done public records requests and seen the behind-the-scenes discussions in their email exchanges, and this is just step one of what their plans are to actually expand the number of animals used at the university.
That's an incredibly brutal picture of this underground torture chamber, basically. That's really f-ing terrible. Would you talk about, so the tour spanned the entire country, and it seems like y'all did a lot of solidarity work as well, or like solidarity visits and stuff like that. And how could you talk about how the tour went?
The tour was largely pretty successful. We did, probably 30 to 50 protests, between office protests and office disruptions to home demos. We went to 30 different locations, probably, of Skanska employee executives, I should say, around the country. And then in cities that had more established communities, we did presentations. We did one in Asheville at Firestorm, for instance. We did presentations to the community, talked about the campaign overview and ways to get involved, and also just sort of the state of the animal liberation movement, what's going on in your community, what can we do to help, how can you plug in to a larger network effort. And that was all great. Everything, all of those stops were very well received. In New York, it was a lot of fun because we got to actually be sort of in the belly of the beast, so to speak. Skanska USA is headquartered in Manhattan. The CEO lives on Long Island. It was great to be able to do a protest outside of his house. And then during the tour, a banner was also dropped in the downtown of his hometown, which is Huntington, New York, which is a small, very affluent community where lots of executives that work in like Wall Street businesses live, like the Bank of New York executives and stuff like that, live in Huntington. It's this very small, affluent downtown. And in the major, the biggest intersection in the town, a banner was dropped that said, his name is Richard Cavallaro, the CEO of Skanska, and said, Richard Cavallaro profits off of animal torture. Skanska is building on animal cruelty. And so that was hanging there in this busy intersection in this tiny affluent town. And that was cool. And then it all sort of culminated in our second march on the University of Washington. We returned back to the Northwest to Seattle and had about, the media estimated, around 300 people marching through the streets of the U District in Seattle. We took over the streets. There was a bit of a standoff with the police. Helicopters were flying overhead, and they had shut down intersections and bridges as we were moving through the university district during University of Washington's first week of classes for the term. It was on October 2nd in Seattle, and this was our second mass demonstration at University of Washington at the site of the lab. And the first one had about 500. This one had about 300, according to media estimates. And this one was a little bit more aggressive than the first. The tone was more somber, but also more determined. We took over the main streets of the university district in Seattle. Police ended up trying to blockade us in different areas. They shut certain intersections down. They actually closed a bridge while we were doing this. And it was a little bit more of a standoff with the police. And I think that it was an illustration of sort of growing anger in the movement about the lab. And it was pretty successful to see so many people be willing to take a stand like that and to stand off with police. They actually ended up bringing riot gear out at the very end before the march ended. And it was also had Jake Conway speak at the march. He spoke at the rally before the march actually set off. Jake from the Shaq campaign and one of the Shaq 7. So that was really great to be participating in an intergenerational grassroots animal liberation movement like that. And then the next day we had four big home demonstrations in Seattle with around 30 people at each, going to Skanska executive homes and UW leadership homes to sort of cap off the weekend and also sort of finish the march, the tour altogether. And that was a great climax way to end the tour.
Yeah, that sounds super successful and exciting, and sounds like a lot got done. Are there people still needing, you know, legal support or anything, money support or anything like that from arrests?
Yeah. With campaigns like this, like, we call this a pressure campaign, and, you know, we support there being a diversity of tactics as a part of it. And we want to develop a campaign strategy that does support everything from letter writing to different forms of direct action. And so that means if there are people taking riskier actions, whether that's just a protest that's aggressive or people who are doing things like locking down at the lab site, we want to make sure that there is a campaign strategy that supports actions like that happening, as well as then the legal support in place to help people out. So there are ongoing criminal as well as civil cases. The people who locked down at the lab site back in June, they were locked to an excavator for 12 hours, stopped work for the day, and they are facing criminal charges for that, and legal support is still needed for them. There have also been arrests at home demos. There are ongoing protection orders against me because of home demos and Skanska trying to stop the campaign by suing activists. So there is definitely continued legal support needed, and we want to do everything we can to support the activists who need that. And we also try and do a lot of work to help people understand what those situations are before they end up in them. Like, we host Know Your Rights trainings and things like that, and try and make, you know, a community that is aware of what things like political repression are and know what to do when cops are at different events, and do what we can to build a strong community against that.
Is there a way for listeners to get y'all donations if they can?
Yeah, there's on our website, which is nonewanimallab.com, there is a donate tab at the top of the page that links to our PayPal. And we are always accepting donations like that. And if folks are good at fundraising and they want to, like, plan an event, like a benefit show or a bake sale or something, we are always encouraging those kind of grassroots fundraising efforts, that we kind of coordinate those and network around that kind of stuff as well, because we want to see communities have community events and kind of support themselves in their own ways by having fun events like that that also support causes that they believe in. So anything from donating if you want to wanting to plan a fundraiser. We're open to all sorts of things. We really want people to take the campaign into their own hands, and that includes if they want to start protesting in their city or if they want to figure out a way to raise funds in a creative way that we may not have thought of on our own. Like, that kind of stuff is, it's open, and we want it to be a pretty decentralized campaign in that way. And we want to see a decentralized movement in that way. And the campaign is one vehicle for that.
I know you mentioned a lot about Skanska, which is the company that was directly under the scrutiny of this tour, but are there any other additional companies that listeners should be aware of as ones who use animal testing widely?
Well, there are tons of research institutions in the United States alone. A lot of the bigger names that people hear about more often are universities. Probably at any university in a college town, there's animal research going on. And that's accessible. If you want to know, you can. There are ways to look that up. And beyond that, there are lots of biomedical institutions that are for-profit companies or so-called nonprofits, but they function like a for-profit company in many ways, and they are all over the country as well. And just like Skanska is building this lab and they're our secondary sort of focus, there are many, many, many companies that are involved in the industry that are the pillars of the animal research industry, those that invest in it and those that provide the animals. There's, you know, Gateway to Hell is a campaign that's still ongoing internationally that is focused on stopping the transportation of animals. On the East Coast, there are a number of ground transport companies that specialize in animal transport. They use trucks to get primates mostly from one place to another. And it's, you know, it's a network, it's a very elaborate network that keeps the animal research industry afloat. And so there are ample ways to get involved. And to name off a few now is probably pretty hard. But I would think about the universities that maybe are in your town, or there are other ways to look up if there's a like a product testing company and things like that as well.
So one of the larger rebuttals to animal testing is the whole question of, but these tests provide life-saving treatments for humans and other animals. Could you talk about why this formatting of like opposition to animal testing is not really useful, if you care to?
Sure. Well, for one, just the way that when people use that as an argument against pro-animal campaigns or anti-vivisection stuff more specifically, it automatically assumes that there has to be humans versus animals dichotomy in the question of animal research. And people oftentimes just take that for granted, that it's an us versus them thing. And it's usually not to convince anyone in the animal rights movement, it's just to convince the general public, who's not going to be very literate in scientific language, and they're just going to assume that if it's coming from the researchers, then it has to be true. But really, with grassroots campaigns like this, it doesn't matter to us, because regardless of whether or not animal research has been useful historically, we can look at the animal research industry and say it exists for one reason, and it's to make money. And animals are being exploited for the benefit of a very few wealthy individuals, researchers who claim to be all altruistic and wanting to save human lives, that are making six figures or more, research companies that are multi-billion dollar companies, construction companies that are building these labs that are multi-billion dollar companies. And it all starts to break down when you realize it's not about human health or biomedical progress. It's about money, and it's about using animals as a means to make money. And if we're going to really build a successful movement, we can't get caught into this false dichotomy that really only benefits the animal research industry. And instead, we need to confront them where it matters to them. And that's their weak points, their pressure points, which is their status, their ability to make profit, their investments, the companies that keep them going, construction companies, financing companies, etc. And our movement needs to be really focused around that and not be so caught up in this question of whether or not some animal research is useful or not. And I think that it's important to remember that it does not matter to the animals one bit, this question of how much it's useful to human health, because no matter what, an animal does not consent to being put in a cage and being tortured and killed, eventually having their bodies cut open and then thrown in biohazard waste containers and used as this never-ending supply of tools. Because it doesn't really matter when you know that if you just take the animal's interest into consideration and that they're always resisting this experience, that the least we can do is look at that and say what we need to be doing is acting in total solidarity with those animals who are experiencing this every day of their lives, every second of their lives, and are resisting nonstop. And if we're going to sit and have an intellectual discussion about the merits of animal research, I think we've totally missed the point, which is not, it's really just about fighting for their liberation, because that's clearly what they want, regardless of whether or not there's merit to animal research.
Also, since the animals are in these desperate situations, and I mean, they don't, as Justin said, like, they don't have time for us to have these intellectual debates about it. And they also don't have time for us to not be effective. And that's why, like, with this campaign, we're targeting Skanska. Because, you know, when we look at, we have the University of Washington and we have Skanska, the University of Washington is heavily invested in being able to continue doing animal research because they want millions more dollars for it. But Skanska as a construction company, this lab project is just one project to them, not worth it to them to lose, you know, their reputation to be associated with animal cruelty and to lose money on a project that's not even making them very much money anyways. And they don't need animal research as an industry to keep going with their business. So when we look at campaigns and how we're going to spend our time, you know, it can be overwhelming to think about how many animals are being tortured in different ways. And so we have to think about, like, what can we do to be effective and to make tangible differences that will actually save animals' lives. And so when we can do something like target a construction company who, if they pull out, it would be very hard for that lab to continue to be built. And so we need to make our campaign decisions based on how we can be effective rather than maybe what sounds fun or what's a good picture for Facebook or think of activism as a hobby. And we need to, you know, think about what the animals are going through and dedicate ourselves wholly to being effective for them.
Definitely. Maybe on that note, as I was reading some of the literature around the tour, noticed that some of the language around it talked about expanding and changing the anti-vivisection movement. Could you talk about the animal rights movement and how you're hoping to affect it with this campaign?
Well, on a number of levels. To provide background for listeners that might not be aware, the animal liberation movement in the United States is still sort of a shadow of its former self. Years of political repression culminating in the Green Scare, not really knowing how to pick up the pieces after that, funneling all of our resources into large nonprofits that are not really empowering grassroots activists and oftentimes are making us look like a joke to larger society and a joke to the industries that we're really ultimately trying to threaten in a very serious way. We think that the movement needs to be rebuilt. You know, that takes a lot of faces, one of which is using a pressure campaign model. This isn't something that's been done in probably about at a national scale since the fall of Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty in the US. Using the kind of strategy that we're trying to develop, as well as a diversity of tactics approach to pressure decision makers at a company like Skanska or decision makers at the University of Washington, utilizing tactics like home demonstrations, etc. None of this is, we're not necessarily saying people have to go and pick a secondary target or have to go home demo, but they need to be thinking about what can we do when we do animal rights campaigns that is actually pressuring those in power in the industries that we want to confront that are abusing animals. And right now, the movement as a whole is not doing that. The movement as a whole is focusing on symbolic one-off demonstrations. They're focusing on once-a-year protests at the circus or once-a-year for Free Friday demonstrations. And none of it, it's all just scattered without focus. And so this campaign, for one, is a vehicle through which people can see a developing strategy and see ways that we can think creatively about maintaining pressure on specific companies, specific institutions, and specific people, and how that can be used as an alternative to what is the norm in the United States animal rights movement, what has become the norm. We also want to see people move past focusing on the novelty of our own political repression, focusing on so much about fear or the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, and be pushing the limits again, be pushing their own comfort zones. We're using tactics where people are getting arrested, where people are clearly going to be put into law enforcement databases. We know that that's part of the game, and we want to normalize that within the movement, because it should be something that we accept when we're doing confrontational movement building and not be afraid, constantly afraid anymore. That's one thing that, another thing that we want this campaign to be able to illustrate to the movement more broadly. And this is all very US specific. The last thing I would say, and I'll see if Amanda wants to add anything, is that we really want to build into our own analysis the idea that animal liberation does not exist in a vacuum, and that when there are really strong land defense campaigns, or when there are social justice movements that are in need of support, and we have the resources to support them, that doing things like coalition building and solidarity work is not only important in its own right, and not only the right thing to do on its own terms, but is also something that is attacking those same pillars of animal industry, and ultimately will weaken the massive structures that are responsible for destroying everything on the planet. And we want to see the animal rights movement get away from this isolated little corner and become a bigger part of liberatory movements in the United States, and to respectfully do so, and to acknowledge the importance of things like solidarity and coalition building.
Something I would add is being willing to be a movement that's critical of itself, because it seems like, especially like in the wake of state repression that made people, you know, more fearful of engaging in some tactics, and things became very much associated with, quote, like safer things, like, you know, the protest hosted by the large nonprofits and things like promoting veganism. And it's become so much more about the humans rather than the animals. People act like it's a victory if they get to eat vegan cupcakes, or if they felt good going to their circus demo and posting their pictures on the internet. And that stuff in itself isn't necessarily problematic, but when the whole movement has become about what makes us feel good rather than if it's having tangible impact for animals, there's a problem there, and we need to be able to step back. And we do this within our own campaign too, is step back, and when we've been engaging in whatever tactic for a while, or if we're developing certain messaging, we as a whole movement need to be able to have those times when we step back and say, okay, what is the impact of this? Is this actually, you know, hurting the industries that are exploiting animals, and is this leading towards animal liberation, or is this just trying to make us feel good because now our lives are easier as vegans, even if it has nothing to do with what has changed for animals.
Yeah, I think that kind of analysis or that kind of critical eye would really benefit a lot of political movements in the United States. That's the only context I know of as well. We're speaking with Amanda and Justin about the No New Animal Lab campaign. More after this brief musical break, where we'll hear the first minutes of the track War Crime by Uninhabitable from their new self-titled release. Uninhabitable is based in Asheville.
We'll be right back.
I was wondering if you could, if you had said all that you wanted to say about the specter of oppression and how to deal with the fact that people might go to jail or the fact that people might be followed by certain like law enforcement groups, is it enough for y'all or like for people that you know to just take that as being kind of a given? Or are there certain tactics that work for you in dealing with that inevitability?
I think that we do need to accept it as inevitable. If we are engaging in work that is effectively impacting the state, I mean, we're talking about, we're protesting animal research. It's an industry that's very entrenched in large corporations that are very powerful, as well as the government itself. And so if we are effectively impacting that in what they view as a negative way, we should expect that there's going to be pushback from them. And so, yeah, to some extent, it has to be part of the game, and we need to expect that. And that's why in the work we do, we need to incorporate things like having legal support set up in campaigns, always doing support for prisoners, and making sure that people never feel forgotten or that people don't know that they would get support. And we also, from the positions that we personally are speaking from, I know that I come from a very privileged background in a lot of ways, and the repression that I face is because of the choices I choose to engage in with activism, and that's a very privileged thing to do. And I cannot just say that, oh, I'm going to step back and not do stuff anymore because I don't like the, you know, being sued or feeling followed by cops or something, because the animals are still suffering and they don't get to have choices like that. And there are a lot of communities that always face repression and they don't have the ability to just step away from that. So it's not okay for us to act like, oh, we experience repression, we should like pull away from what we're doing. Instead, we need to figure out how to deal with it in different ways. And that doesn't mean that it's not going to be stressful or that there won't be hard times, but we need to figure out different ways to be able to deal with it and not let it destroy our movement.
I mean, a lot of the other stuff that we spoke to earlier surrounding changing the analysis about how animals figure into social structures and oppressive structures more broadly, there's a myth in the animal rights movement that I think goes largely unidentified. I don't know if that's intentional or if that's not, that animal advocates believe that we can look to existing social structures for really substantive change for animals, that we can look to the state to help us make animals' lives better, or to help us liberate animals, that we can look to corporations to change their policies, to enact new policies to help animals. And then in the long run, that none of those things need to be totally transformed. And there's a lack of that sort of transformative analysis about the world around us that will make those moments when repression comes down all the more difficult for us to handle as a movement. Because, oh my God, who would have thought that the United States government would do such a thing? And we scramble because as a movement, because we're so largely so privileged as a movement, it's shocking to us because it's not part of our everyday experiences. It's not part of our day-to-day realities that the state and the police and these different structures are not there to protect us, because for a lot of us, they are there to protect us because it's a very white movement. It's a very relatively affluent movement. And so we don't see repression as a lived experience the way that so many oppressed communities do. Instead, we see it as a novelty, which we can disengage from by dropping out of the movement, by not being vegan anymore, by snitching or whatever. And all of a sudden we're fine again and we can go back to living our affluent, privileged lifestyles. And I think that changing the analysis altogether is going to be necessary, because when repression comes knocking again, it won't be so surprising next time if we're like, oh yeah, because this is what these structures are meant for. This is what the state functions to do. And the whole idea of criminality is a social construct that only serves those in power. And if we don't believe that stuff, when our friends get visits from the FBI, we just turn into a mess as a movement, you know? And I think that all movements are not going to deal with that well, because it's a horrible thing. But I think that's a unique problem that we face. And I think also the environmental movement in the United States tends to face as well, for a lot of the same reasons, is that we think that we can get gains from these very oppressive institutions because we think that they can be neutral. We think that the state can be neutral to animals. We just have to make our case better. That's obviously not true. Those things do not exist to help animals at all. In fact, they are the infrastructure of the oppression of countless living beings. And until we start to question those things in a very fundamental way, when we talk about repression, we're going to always come back to the same place and continue to reinvent the wheel, continue to talk about the Green Scare for 10 years without any changing analysis. It's very frustrating. I think that's a big reason why we haven't been able to move past things like the AETA, and we still talk about it exactly how the government wants us to. They want us to just have these scary discussions and then do nothing. They don't mind that we're having workshops about the AETA. All it does is spread information that spreads fear. And without the footnote of this larger discussion, we do nothing to help ourselves or the animals.
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps like on that tip to get folks' wheels spinning, can you point listeners to resources that are well-researched and accessible who would like to learn more about animal testing and debates around it?
Oh, there's tons of resources about animal testing and debates around it. I mean, I honestly wouldn't know where to start, depending on the perspective you're looking for.
Do you have a favorite one?
I'm not interested in debates about, I mean, what's your question more specifically?
Perhaps I'm also more interested in pointing listeners to resources specifically discussing animal testing.
I mean, I would just tell people to watch some investigation videos from inside labs and see what the animals are going through and let the animals themselves convince you that their lives are worth fighting for and they shouldn't be in those situations.
If you're interested in knowing more about, say, how the industry works or like how expansive and ubiquitous it is, but meaning like that there are labs all over the place and there are X amount of animals in them, I mean, the NIH website will tell you so much information about which animals are in which labs if you know how to do the right research. And the USDA has that information. I mean, it's just data, but it exists. And then Stop Animal Exploitation Now has a pretty good compiled list of the types of research that are going on in different places. But if I were to point people to like a truly anti-vivisection, I don't know, it's hard to say. It sucks that like shack resources no longer exist, but even a lot of stuff in the UK, like the BUAV, has a lot of good resources about how the industry works, the British Union to abolish vivisection. They have anything from how the transport industry works to how the, you know, breeding facilities, where are they, and which labs are doing contract research, which labs are doing university-style research, which is definitely different than product testing. And they have a lot of investigations, and they have a lot of information about the industry as a whole, probably more than most groups on an international level, at least, I would say. And then a lot of the investigations that the BUAV has done has been, those investigations have been sort of the underpinnings of lots of really great campaigns like Shack or Gateway to Hell. And the BUAV has a really actually kind of interesting radical history. Their newsletter from the 80s called Liberator has tons of information about vivisection. And it's still, you know, from a historical perspective, it's probably the best resource. It's available online. You can look up BUAV Liberator and see sort of how the industry has changed over the years in response to animal rights activism.
Awesome. And I might just encourage listeners to read up on the Shack and the Shack 7 as a way to like look into how to do stuff. What is the next step for the campaign?
Well, kind of still in the midst of it, but over this weekend was Haunt Skånska, where we encouraged people to do Halloween-themed demonstrations and other actions. And so there were protests in executives' homes during trick-or-treat time in Portland and D.C., L.A. There's
New York.
Denver. Yeah, New York at the CEO's house. There's also a banner that was dropped over the highway in Denver area. So that was cool seeing people have some fun with the Halloween holiday. Soon we'll be starting to announce information for a mass convergence against Skånska in New York later in the winter.
by the time this airs, that will have been announced. Oh, so yeah, you can look it up. Information will be on our website.
Yes.
Which again is nonewanimallab.com.
Awesome. And I think that you have answered the last question that I have, which was how can folks get involved if they're not in Washington State? But do you have anything to say about on that tip?
Yeah. I mean, you don't even need to have a Skanska office in your city to be involved in the campaign. You don't have to be in the United States even to be involved in the campaign. But we post lots of information on our website and on our Facebook that if you're interested, just follow that, because you'll see if we have, you know, letter writing events planned. You'll see if we have phone actions planned, which anyone can call in when we do things like phone and email blockades. And you'll see when we have events planned in specific places. You'll see when we have fundraisers planned or we're doing a donation drive or anything like that will be posted online. And we try to provide outlets for folks that aren't able to engage in protests, because we don't want it to be just a protest outside of an office-based campaign anyway. So if you are interested in getting involved and you just want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email or get a hold of us on Facebook, and we could communicate with you about what you want to do. And, you know, we can have discussions about creative new ways to be involved in the campaign, because we're pretty open to that stuff.
You can also see on our website in one of the recent posts, there is now a map up of the locations of the Skanska offices, as well as the homes of executives for Skanska, as well as UW leadership addresses. So people can look at that information and write letters or plan protests. So yeah, we can help connect you with stuff that where people are already engaging in the campaign, or that is a great way to find if there's something near you that hasn't been protested yet, or write letters or whatever people want to do with that information.
That's awesome. Those are all the questions that I have written out, but is there anything that you would like to speak to that we did not cover?
I think we should reiterate to folks, especially because y'all are based on the East Coast, if I'm correct, right?
That's correct.
Do everything you can to join us in New York City. The event there will be a big national demo, and it'll be the first one of the campaign that's not on the West Coast. So this is a great opportunity to get involved in a real grassroots animal liberation effort, as well as networking with folks from all around the country to converge in New York. So
in January.
And the information is online. You can look it up, and we'll post more as the date draws near. But for now, just do everything you can to commit to that weekend, to being in New York, which is January 16th and 17th. Friday the 15th through Sunday the 17th, plan on being in New York.
Awesome. And we will be announcing that on the show as it gets closer to it.
Thank you
all so much for coming onto the show and taking time and talking about the No New Animal Lab campaign. This was really
Thanks
awesome.
For having us.
Thank you.
For the end of the show, we're going to listen to Nothing to Win by Yob off of their most recent album, Clearing the Path to Ascend. Yob is a doom metal band from Salem, Oregon, and they're going to be playing at the Mothlight with the heavy hitters known as Black Cobra from Oakland. The show information can be found at themothlight.com. It's on Tuesday, the 10th of November.
Drive on!
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Or if you care to, you can send us actual letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. We've been talking with Justin and Amanda about the No New Animal Lab campaign. To learn more about this campaign and for more information on the upcoming demo in New York on January 15th through 17th, you can visit their website at nonewanimallab.com and click the Take Action tab. To contact our interviewees, you can shoot them an email at info@nonewanimallab.com. And if you feel in a position to donate to any legal defense, you can go to their website and click the Donate button. Up next is Wordplay with Lockie and Jeff, in which they talk about poetry and sometimes with poets and with actual poems. Stay tuned.